August 4th. We're looking at a local law amending the charter of the code regarding prohibitions prohibiting evictions without cause.
I mean, I think this is in line with a lot of the fair housing policies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very much in line with that. So it seems like, hey, oh, and Michelle probably knows.
Well, given that we have a very other weightier thing we're working on, and mm-hmm. I'm
saying,
so.
We can put this aside for now anyway.
But find out what all these
yeah, sure. Right, this is not...
Wait before we get discussion going on and find out if it's been passed and all of it. See if they're...
So, let's go to the main subject of tonight, the inclusionary zoning. So, Jeff pointed out to me in conversation that there are actually two references to it. One we know about, which is the terraces. And then there's another one. Do you want to summarize that, Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, it's similar. It's somewhat similar to what we're talking about. It's an incentive zone.
Can you speak up on the mic?
Right, I'll turn that off.
Basically provides density bonuses for affordable housing, among other amenities, and includes if you have to do with other public benefits, there's an incentive zoning for that, but as we're talking about here is,
and what district is it specifically?
I think it's in all the districts.
Okay.
Admitted and limited, actually it's not. No, it's any residential district.
Does it
and it has to increase of 20 or 30% increased density depending if it's low or moderate income.
So you're saying that's in the code already? Is the
yeah, I mean, it's not a mandatory. It's an incentive provision.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we've had that. I don't know if it's ever been used. The terrace provision one, I don't think has ever been used, and I find it frankly incomprehensible.
Well, it seems, I mean, I had assumed it was put into place at the same time as the agreement with the terrace's developer.
Well,
was,
no.
No, it was put in,
I don't know.
It was prior, Carol?
No, because it was put into
prevent.
Code when it appeared that the original 30-year pilot for the terraces was going to be over. And it was uncertain about what was going to happen. But what happened was another group bought the entire, development,
right,
and got another pilot for another 30 years.
And then it was subsequently attached to that.
Well, no, it's
no, it was for that, so that to make sure that stayed affordable housing.
Well, it actually was adopted at the exact same time as the same law as the incentive zoning provision.
Uh-huh.
What year?
2011. Same time all the waterfront work was done.
Right.
Because it was sort of somewhat related to that. It was wrapped together.
Okay. So...
So in terms of the regular incentive zoning provision, I don't know if anybody's been using that or has tried to.
I haven't heard it.
No, there's nothing.
Since, to reconcile a little bit.
Well, that's a good question. I was trying to think about that. Would there be a reason? Would you replace this and take this out and just do your mandatory inclusionary zoning? Would it make sense to keep them together? Could they work in parallel somehow?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you could have them together. They're sort of inherently inconsistent because on one ways you're trying to promote the private development by giving somebody a density bonus in exchange for the housing, and the other one you're doing a straight extraction with no benefit to the developer.
Right, well, that was the debate point that we did.
Well, they were raising the question. Right, well, was, and the whole question is that, again, you could write it, but are you going to, you know, foreclose
so
all the
So do you not have a draft for us today?
I don't still have one now, because I've been working on it, because I've been trying
but, like,
to reconcile
this is getting really, really absurd, Jeff. I don't understand what the problem is. Like, you are supposed to draft some laws so that we can have something to talk about and something to move forward.
I'm working on it, and I will
I mean, how, like, it's been, I don't know how many months, how many months have we been having these meetings? Maybe 10?
No.
No.
Actually, since April.
Since
yeah.
April, okay, so, but there's literally no excuse, and there needs to be some movement on this. Okay, we've gone back over these points, we've brought up what are the potential things that we need to be thinking about, and now we need to have something to work on.
Well, that's true, but then I think we also should decide how we're going to make a sort of a global view.
I mean, another option is maybe somebody else can do this.
Well, hold on a second.
Well, I'm still asking you for the guidance on how do you want to reconcile this, just putting
right.
putting forward a separate standalone law. You know, is that worth an effort to do it? Is it going to go anywhere? And how are you going to reconcile with these other provisions that you have there in the code? You can't just simply ignore them.
Okay.
I mean, you could, but it's reckless.
Well, so can you, I mean, okay, fine.
Well, we have to decide that.
Cool. So, but I mean, we don't have to wait another month to figure that out.
Well, we have to debate this right now. How do you set
right.
up this? The
I mean, this is part of the guidance.
What you're saying, not discounting what you're saying.
Right.
But if there's already contradictory parts of the code, and that's something we just leave, and for the sake of going forward quickly, we just layer in something else that is
right
and contradictions.
Okay, so the density bonus, I mean, typically a density bonus is something that is offered as part of inclusionary zoning, so it would be easy to, like, make a case for just...
Well, you can incorporate that into this.
Right. So, but we haven't, I mean, so far what we've gone back and forth about is whether we feel that we need to incentivize, and you seem to suggest that there's a, like, danger of a taking thing... If there's not a specific...
I think it was less of a taking more than it was a disincentive for at some point
for people to be invested
to invest in property and build. So the question is, what's that tipping point between encouraging development and discouraging development vis-a-vis mandate or consent?
I mean, okay. It seems like it would be a lot more possible for us to really start to figure these things out if we had a draft that was constructed with a variety. Yeah. And I think, and I read over our minutes, you actually were charged with creating two drafts for this meeting. One that showed like what it would look like if we had an option for an in lieu of fee, and one that showed if we didn't.
Oh.
And we've got nothing. So, I mean, there has to be something done. Like, this cannot continue. We cannot keep meeting month after month with nothing to
do. Well, we can simplify this and say, we know we have to reconcile the confusion in the code. So we could have two drafts, essentially. We're saying one is the inclusionary zoning with the density bonus as the incentive, and the other one is clearly without.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then that's it.
Well, what we had talked about before was having the straight incentive zoning with the requirement to provide the inclusionary zoning, to require the units to be there, and the other one is to allow the buyout, the payout system.
Right.
Now we want to put an incentive element.
Well, here would be the question. Would a density bonus, if we're going to just have two things for comparison, so then we go to the full council. Would a density bonus work in lieu of a paying into a housing trust fund, et cetera, like we were talking about? Would this be using the density bonus language during the code, adopting that rather than creating a law that has a fee to be paid in lieu of
can you repeat what you just said?
Meaning if we adopt the density bonus language, that becomes the incentive rather than what we were talking about before, which was the fee to be paid into housing.
Right, I mean, what we had, I think one of the possible ways we had discussed doing the in lieu of fee is basically to make it really high.
Right.
You know, so that if somebody was going to, so that it wouldn't just be a simple decision for a developer like, oh, sure, we'll just pay the fee instead of doing this thing.
So now I think what we're looking at is just to force the process along, jettisoning all that fee language. Two courses of action. We either go with that or we just borrow the density bonus as the incentive.
I mean, one thing I would back to, like, to actually discuss a density bonus, I think height could be a real bummer for us.
Well, I was thinking that.
Right. Like, height is, yeah.
It's more of a bummer.
It depends on where you're building.
It means, right.
What height you're building at. And I think, as you know.
Well, what you're talking about is when you're generally talking about the bonus, and I was going where you were thinking of this, is you give a height exception.
Right.
On the zoning code.
Exactly.
You've got to go high. You know, put another floor on it or something.
Right. And we can specify that to certain areas, not, you know.
Well, that's the question, right? Do you only allow it to be done in certain districts, or you open it up? And having if you're going to have mandatory set-asides and extractions, but allow people to either provide it or get density bonuses, I would have the fee way out of it also to sort of get out of the problem of forcing people to get bigger where you may not want them to.
Well, we're not forcing anybody to do anything because they always have the option of actually making the units affordable, which would be, to my mind, actually the thing that we want.
Well, you're saying that without any economic analysis.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we've been talking to, I mean, I have had conversations with different, you know, developers and planners, and I think that it's understood that, like, it's feasible to create affordable units.
It's one thing to say it's feasible. The point stands in that I've talked about it as well, the same thing. It's not to say that you're wrong. It's just, like, unless we have a really in-depth economic analysis of the phenomenon, we're just going to be basically going on our gut and research.
Well, I think it makes sense to stand on the backs of the analyses that have already been done rather than, like, that's the whole, you know, you don't want to. So we've spent time looking at other.
Except your analysis that aren't specific to here. So again, if you're dealing with a larger community, say 50,000 people,
well,
there's a different.
Also, you know, there's only one community that's done.
But nonetheless, there's still, if it's
on how it's played out.
If we want to model laws based on larger communities that have different developmental pressures, then therefore they don't necessarily work here. But I support what you're saying. Broadly, it's just we can't guarantee that what we're doing is going to affect an outcome that's positive for affordability in that way that you're saying. That's all I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Without really studying.
To speak to that, I talked to a developer today who actually said we're getting a reputation for making it too hard for developers. And this is an affordable housing developer, by the way. So, you know, what are you going to do?
That's because we give them a hard time about pilots. That's what that's about.
They weren't actually looking for a pilot, but that's a whole other.
Well, but I mean, that would be what the reputation
yeah.
is based on.
Sure.
It's not, there's nothing
well,
else.
No, there is. I mean, there's design features and all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like we're not, I mean,
yeah.
that's not the right developer, maybe.
No, I mean, that's not the issue. It's just an anecdote that I think is relevant.
Sure. It's just like, I think that it's pretty.
Look, we don't have that many places to develop. We have to remember that.
Right? Yeah.
So, you know, on the one hand, that's where the density bonus in a small community like this becomes a very attractive way to incentivize types of development because we should be thinking about a denser urban footprint here over time because of environmental concerns, et cetera. And we need that type of project. You know, we need to at least hope we could have that type of increase.
Are there areas of the town, the city, that are more conducive to more high-rise development, and not necessarily into the current zone, but, you know, to adapt that, where you focus that and transfer rights, or what do you
mean? I mean, I would say, you know, you have to balance, obviously, historical aesthetics and the present, and preservation
outside
guide.
Of the historic areas, I guess, right?
But then also try to figure out how that balance works between aesthetic considerations, historical considerations.
house.
So how does the density bonus work? I mean, what is the actual density we're talking about there?
They get a you increase the density allowed by 20 or 30%.
20 or 30%. Allowed
based on, the number of affordable units that they create.
No, I think wouldn't it be bulk of the site?
Yeah, that is a good question.
I mean, it must be based on, you know, the quantity of affordability that they're providing. Like, that, there must be some calculation that's...
Not necessarily. It could be just...
Actually, it does not even say. I think it presumes in this one that it's... it's a really good question, because I think as it's written, it doesn't necessarily presume mixed use.
So it's just for strictly affordable developments?
Sorry, mixed income or mixed use?
Hey, Jeff, do you mean to say income?
Yeah, not income. Wait.
Did you mean mixed income or mixed use?
Mixed income, I'm sorry, mixed income. That's really fun.
Well,
because somebody says they're providing the affordable housing, guaranteed that it will continue for at least 40 years, and maintain its affordability or as proof of it.
So it makes sense that the context of the law was to the terraces.
This part isn't.
What would they mean?
This one isn't the one that's tied to the terraces. This is the broader one. So that's an interesting question. We're certainly changing, you know, working with that on the incentive zoning existing law to start putting in, you know, a provision for what percentage of affordable or how you get is a, you know, per unit increase.
Right. Well, starting from what we've been working with before, we basically were mandating X and then saying to get out of X, Y is a fee payment. Or now there's this extra wrinkle, which is the existing density bonus. So do the two work together, or, you know, if we're going to develop two laws for us to work on, one that has no incentives and one that has incentives out there in the code versus a fee. I mean, perhaps including the fee with the density bonus. Mm-hmm. So those are the two things we should be working on. So we could have.
Go to the other direction. Have you decided how many units this is going to apply to? Didn't we have a minimum?
Well, I mean, we gave Jeff a draft like a really long time ago that has a kind of a schedule of how it can apply, and it's basically, I think we started with four units, and the idea was a 25% affordability mandate in any kind of development, four or more units. And then we talked about, well, like, how, I mean, basically that works at four units because, of course, then you have one unit. But then the idea could be, we could have a thing where if it's, say, like nine or more units, it becomes 20% instead of 25%, something like that. Just because 20% seems to be a common number.
And since that is really talking about new construction,
existing renovation.
So if the 20% makes sense, we're talking about a new construction grant. So.
Am I allowed to
say? Sure.
Yeah.
So the idea of like mandatory can mean like you have
you still have choices within that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're talking about mandatory. I'm hearing it from everyone using different ways. So we're saying we want mandatory, like no matter what, this applies to you. But like, you can either choose to give the affordable units in this scenario. And if you give affordable, you can get density bonuses. You can also get like expedited planning processes and easier things, or you pay in lieu fee.
Mm-hmm.
There's the other mandatory, which I think I've also heard, which is you have to do this no matter what in any part of the city, and there's no...
Right,
so
that's the two versions
right.
of the... Yeah.
I have never seen a municipality that doesn't give any benefit,
mm-hmm.
and I've never seen a municipality that doesn't give a choice.
Right.
Like, I've seen one that's like, you have to have a unit, but it can be in the downtown district, you have to, but if you're uptown, you don't have to, because
right.
a lot of like bigger places use this to push the affordable housing into a certain area, right?
Right.
No,
so
I understand. I mean, the way that we've been talking about this is that Hudson, because of its size,
yeah.
that there's an actual imperative to really, and because of the stated desirability of scattered site affordable housing in the city, which is part of the Strategic Housing Action Plan, that we really actually want the affordable units.
I know what you're saying. What I'm saying is like, our scale is so different. So normally, like scattered site, like this is all one school district, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're in Boston, scattered site means you can get a better school district, you can get a better park. So like, I feel like inclusionary zoning is used to get development in those areas where development costs are typically higher.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just saying that the way
public services.
Right. So the way like it's typically done is just very different than what we're trying to do here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm just saying it's different. Because for a scattered site doesn't mean that you get like the market benefit is not as great a difference between Lower Warren Street and like Upper Warren Street as it is if you're in like the Bronx and Midtown.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where inclusionary zoning has like gotten to like fill in that gap.
Mm-hmm.
Is like we're giving you this better real estate, and so you have more of that like feasibility sandwich. And so it's a little bit different here because we're such a small place, right? So like the feasibility thing, like that is a piece of it, right? Is like, will developers able to and want to? And then, is it legal to not give them anything?
Right.
Right? Like, you can't, if you're saying you can't have an in-lieu fee, you're not, because like, then also, if everyone gets a density bonus and you have to do this, then that's kind of just changing the zoning code.
Right.
So.
Well, that's what, I mean, I liked the idea of the just really high in-lieu
yeah.
fee.
And then you could give, like, I think, honestly, I was talking to Stephen earlier about and like the planning process.
Oh, Stephen, sorry. Okay.
Yeah, and just like because I've heard this. I've been trying to talk to developers to get estimates for you guys on housing prices, and it's just been a long conversation because prices have fluctuated so much. So I'm trying to get that data on like what's feasible, and I keep hearing that like the process here is unpredictable, and that's why some developers.
Well, but I really think that that's about the pilot. That, I mean, I believe that the pilot...
Not at
all.
That's just one factor. Does the planning board process seems a little unclear sometimes to developers, and there's a lot of, like, coming and going. And I'm not saying things are, like, insurmountable. I'm just saying that there are things to, like, consider.
Make the argument about a form-based code or something to streamline the process of planning.
I think overall the perception is that there's a tremendous amount of pushback against the building of affordable housing in the city, and that has many forms, including people saying like, well, the parking, you know, which is, these are legitimate questions,
mm-hmm.
but just that...
Well, also a monopoly provider as well, and, you know, I don't know if there's a real negative pushback here, it depends on the form where the pilots are being advocated. Clearly,
the issue is not just pilots. It's
yes.
The issue is the rest of the approval process.
Agreed.
The pilot is certainly one element of it.
Well, I'm looking back to the fact that like Bruce Levine, a very reputable, very active affordable housing developer, was denied a pilot in Hudson for Crosswinds.
Yeah.
So
that was a lot.
I was there.
Yeah.
Longer. That's why I was 2009.
Yeah,
Carol's right, it was.
It's 2006.
2006, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah.
Right.
It's in rememberable history. It's not like.
Yeah,
know.
But I don't. I think the point. I think.
I mean, I don't know what the issues were. Mm-hmm.
But to this point, now we bring into the idea of like, okay, well, a fee is a good, if that's a good incentive in a small community for a developer, then is it the idea that you make it like so high that no one wants to pay it and make affordable, then to build affordability? I think that acts as, well, that might act as a disincentive. Someone might say, like, screw it, if I don't have the chance to buy out of it reasonably, we have to make that, you know, we have to argue that if we're small, we're a geographically small community, we have to consider these.
So, you know, I guess the question of how much housing do we need developed and what do we need to do to get it, I guess, is an ongoing question.
Well, it's clear that you can't presume, the things that we were presuming, you and I, when we started working on this versus the realities of it are clear that, you know, trying to use inclusionary zoning models from larger communities and graft them here under certain assumptions is not a correct course of action. So this is why this is taking longer.
Or at least
longer.
Michelle brought up a really good point, which I, you know, mm-hmm. hadn't really thought of in terms of what the point is of scattered housing.
What
should
it
be?
Which is
clearly
here.
The point.
It's
yeah.
just, it looks a little different. Yeah. And I think I also was wondering if you guys have thought about how we're going to regulate the affordability, because like right now affordable housing is either like HHI or Section 8 voucher, or if you have like a LIHTC, then like the LIHTC people do it. So if we're asking like I'm gonna create a little apartment building for houses, do we have a way of making sure that like we're screening incomes, I'm checking incomes, I'm paying the right rent?
Well, when there's supposed to be a rental registry, or at least I mean that's part of code enforcement is to.
But
yeah, but they're not going to be checking incomes.
Screening tenants, that's the other, that's a whole other type of cost in terms of income requirement before someone lives. It's a good point.
Well, we have in the currently in the incentive zoning law an annual certification that they're maintaining the essentially the income bands. They file something.
I'm sorry, where is that in the code?
That's in the incentive zoning.
How would that be, to your point, Michelle, how would that be monitored?
The question is, they would self-report and they would sort of be subject to the city doing an audit in that.
Who's the tenant self-report what they're paying or the landlord?
I think this is the landlord, I suppose. The way they have it is the landlord provides that information annually.
Okay.
But
then, yeah, so that's another thing.
I
was like, who is
that? I mean, I would think for a city like this, yeah. I mean, I think it's a very good point, is relying more on a self-certification. With an opportunity for an audit if there's complaints or concerns.
Okay.
But you're not going to want to create somebody a new task for somebody to have to do that on their own.
And anybody who's going for a bigger project is obviously going to go for state funding, and they would require.
Right,
that's how
they do that. The LIHTC
thing. Right.
That's the LIHTC.
That's what you're talking about, right?
That's
yeah,
the LIHTC.
Like the tax credit stuff, like all those
right.
tax folks are all making sure they're getting their money.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But so these, you know, right, so these are good questions and have, like, just like, you know, the enforcement is something that has to be figured out, for sure.
One other thing I want to bring up is that Rebecca asked me about, because last time, the meeting, you guys were discussing, like, what is workforce housing?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you have any more thoughts on that. I wrote up some things. Hot off the press because I didn't know this meeting, but if it's helpful at all. Basically, like, this is kind of it's rough. But basically, workforce housing is right now in Hudson, it's like below 100% AMI. So if we're looking at like AMI restrictions, it would like pertain to most workforce housing careers. What's tricky is like right now most of our affordable housing is like low income people,
mm-hmm.
people who have more of like predictable fixed incomes. So if you're someone who's like a teacher who may get a raise next year, or a firefighter, or a waiter who get more tips, it's gonna be a little tricky with like you might not want to live in like a restricted income apartment.
Mm-hmm.
So then the question is like, would this, would, are we going to create more lower AMI and then more luxury, but not like 120%?
Right.
Well, I think the, I mean, the stated goal of this, this program is to be a workforce. That's why we're looking at that, is that this is meant to address workforce.
Except she's now. Right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And again, yes.
In terms of what happens with the workforce tenants, whatever we say workforce defined as, you know, 100% of AMI, say, when they make more money.
Right, and so it's how do we get, we need, like...
How does that normally come?
You have to move, right?
I think...
I mean, it's,
well, the Crosswinds and Terraces, they have to move.
Yeah, once they get an income threshold, you have.
Yeah.
So I think some places, the way they do it, they have a bigger rent.
Terraces, they increase your rent.
Are you sure?
It's not true. The mayor had to leave.
But did they give you, did they give you that
choice?
No.
He said he had to. Increase your, they give you the chance to increase your rent if you cross the threshold, to give you a, like a market rate.
That's what I believe to be true, and actually the first time the mayor told the story of why he had to leave Hudson Terrace, he said that his rent was going up and he decided to leave. But he seems to have changed. He seems
to have, feel different ways on different days.
So maybe we should just reach out and figure out what's happening with the tenants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and give you that. It needs to be confirmed, because I don't think they kick you out. I think they just raise
the rent. How about Crosswinds?
And I don't know what happens.
Well, with, I know with Crosswinds has a, there is a, like, there's a threshold. Like, you can't, if you make above a certain amount, you can't be there.
Michelle, is that into your experience?
Wait, you're saying they move you out. They tell you to leave.
Yes.
Okay. Well, she was saying that's true.
Yeah,
okay.
I
was saying, right. But Carol was saying that wasn't true. Never mind.
And then some places have a bigger, when you go right, you can go up to 120%.
Right.
Right.
And like, I think people who are close to that much money would choose not to live in those apartments usually, but as long as it's like 80% would.
Right.
Could they have a little bit of room?
Research that point.
So apparently Crosswinds does move you out if you go over the amount.
I mean, I guess it, of course it does make sense if the goal is to provide.
Sure.
Right, for other housing.
But whether or not with the schedule in which you have to move, if they give you a probationary period or if you're on.
And do they fluctuate with the AMI as it fluctuates? Mm-hmm. They don't.
Yeah, and that's like not, that's like HUD will give the county, and they have an inflation rate formula.
Okay.
It's a little clunky, you know?
Okay, but it does increase, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's HUD county AMI, right? Mm-hmm. HUD determines the county, and that's for us too.
Which, I mean, our AMI is so much lower than the county, so mm-hmm. in a way that gives us some breathing room, that like more people are eligible here, because people who are like, they might be 100% of the city AMI, but there might only be 65% of the county AMI.
Oh.
So that kind of helps us in that like workforce housing zone.
Is there city AMI dead?
Like, you can calculate it from like census data, but it's like meaningless to like HUD and programs from that. They don't use that. But it's like useful for us to know like what our residents make.
Right, and we've, that's been something we've discussed pretty extensively, I think, is the question of whether, you know, whether we can calculate the requested affordability based on actual AMI of Hudson as opposed to the county, since workforce is kind of a fictional, like, or not fictional, but it's like it doesn't have a fixed meaning. So that's something that,
you know, it would seem, since the Hudson AMI is not official and it's harder to develop, I think what Michelle's saying is we just take the county AMI with a lower percentage.
Yeah, that's kind of what we arrived at, I think, already.
Yeah.
It's like,
and just that we like have try and have more if our goal is to have like help more lower income, then we just want to target a high percentage of units for them.
Well, I think the goal is really just to address the actual workforce needs of Hudson as opposed to of the county. You know, so like, which is lower income.
When you're thinking workforce, are you thinking someone who's on like a fixed income who could qualify for Section 8? Or are you thinking someone who's making like $7,000 a year, $50,000 a year?
I think we're talking more about people who are, you know, who are not Section 8, who are like
income or even mobile in a way.
Yeah, like, you know, the range of workforce. I mean, I think that's, again, like, another question. I mean, when I think of workforce, I think of everybody from, like, some young person wanting to, like, come live in Hudson and work at a store in Hudson, like somebody who's going to work at, you know, a clothing shop on Warren Street.
So the bar graph on there, that's showing, like, average salaries for professionals in Hudson, and then the table under it shows, like, what percent AMI that would fall under, if that helps at all, like,
right.
Oh, got it. Yeah.
Which table? Figure one?
Page 3.
Page 3.
Yeah.
I don't know if that like, helps in terms of the careers you're discussing.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah,
birds.
Yeah, retail salesperson.
And these are monthly salaries?
Yeah.
Right. So. I mean, the idea is to try to create like a city that has an actual like range of, you know, different socioeconomic life in it, so that it's a real city and not just like an emptied out shell.
And also, I guess in terms of development patterns for affordable housing, it seems considering the pilots that are being put in front of the city right now, we're building a lot of capacity at the very low end.
Right.
Beyond demand, probably. And if the demand is actually
in this,
what we're targeting here, that's another my concern in general about the pilot process that we're doing right now, is that what happens when you build a lot of demand at a very low rate beyond the actual demand for the community?
Well,
you're building excess demand, and then you have to market that demand.
I don't think that's what we're dealing with.
Well, this is different, but I think that's an issue that we have to talk about in terms of what we're dealing with for building this community. There is a problem about the workforce. People are living here, working in the stores on Warren Street, not being able to afford rent. And then the easier way is for large developers to build the types of pilot-based affordable housing that meets the lowest end of the...
Well, but which we also need. So that's...
Yeah, but to the size. So it's easier to build the scale. Which
well,
is
I mean, I'm not sure I buy into your
well, I'm
concept
saying,
that would... You're building too much of the lower income housing.
I'm just saying.
No, I think they're going to exceed what the demand is. I mean, if people are able to move and go into it, they
are
providing the labor force for the local.
But it happened when we built, when Bliss was built, essentially. So the problem is, I'm just saying the economics, the scale, are built the way that the state and federal money, the state of low income housing tax credits work to incentivize one type of scale development, and we're trying to look at another smaller scale.
Right. Okay. Right.
To meet a more fluid, working, poor, however you define it, workforce.
The only thing I think about is if these developers, like the people, like you're saying, people, so people who are going, I think we need all income brackets, right? And
right.
Like, right. But if we're getting these like LIHTC projects that are doing 30% AMI, with this inclusionary zoning ordinance, is this your tool to try and get 100% AMI or 80% AMI?
That would be the goal.
Right.
And if that is, then that like gap between what's market rate and what's feasible like in this ordinance like gets smaller, right? That like if you are charging $800 a month for rent versus $350, this becomes a little more feasible for developers.
No, totally. And that's what we're definitely
right, so
I agree with you. It's that little box right there between $800 and
$1,200
a month. I mean, I drew the box. I don't, it's not that. It just.
Okay, that's very precise.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, the tricky part of calculating this, right, is like not everyone's a one person family or two.
Right.
So, like, and that when you're in a bigger city, those numbers shake out, but when you're this small, like, those numbers add up, right? Like, those estimations for doing.
Right.
Estimates for doing.
So, yeah.
So Michelle, certainly an incentive that's the best way forward with this law, correct? Would you say?
I'm not saying the best. I'm saying
or that. Well, maybe the best is the wrong way to put it.
Well, I guess there's two questions, like which we keep coming back to. What's legal? Like, is it legal to have no incentives? And
what would make it not legal? Would it be the taking thing?
Yes.
That's
exactly what it is.
Okay, so I guess then isn't it a thing where the onus is on the developer to show that they're not able to make like adequate profit at some point? Like,
well, no, that's a good question. It's more of an issue of it's a nice mix because it's.
And I mean, we just went
we're
through.
We're trying to think of it. The case law is very complex, and I'm trying to remember what I've seen that's analogous to this in terms of you extract the public benefit from a developer, and there has to be a nexus to the public need and the impact. But most often, that is done in the context of providing like beach access or public access areas or set asides for playgrounds and space. Cases dealing with what we're talking about here of requiring a percentage of lower income because you're not guaranteed the right to maximize your income or your profit on the property. You can't be denied. It's a diminution in value, and one line of legal thought says you can't do that, you shouldn't do that. Another say you can't. But I don't think it's really been settled much. But Michelle's right. It's one difference that's separate from just the legal question is, are you disincentivizing so much that people are not making the investments in the community?
Right,
but I mean, honestly, like, I just, like, this is an opportunity zone. There's developers, like...
But that's just that's a Trump tax credit phenomenon that he came back to develop, and who knows how that's going to play out over time. That doesn't mean
that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah.
The city is
an opportunity. Is it an opportunity like lower case though? Like,
no. It's one of the opportunity zones. Yeah.
But also, that's there's a lot of debate about whether that means that it's supposed to incentivize development, but it might be turning into something where rich people park more money and don't do anything.
Right.
And those opportunity zones that benefit from a very neoliberal.
I really think like the danger of not. I mean, like what is it that we're afraid of if developers don't come?
You stress the tax base, and that's something we have to be considering.
But like, how much development do we want? There isn't that much possible, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
So there's
we're
not.
We're talking about generally the redevelopment of existing buildings.
Right, in that category. The other category that you.
You're right. It's not an issue of your vacant lots being done.
Right. But people renovating houses with multiple units.
It's conversions and renovations.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And where are you going to trigger that? You've got to trigger it pretty easily.
Yeah, I mean.
It does.
Which I don't disagree with. Because that's, again, what you want to do for your housing stock is or your building stock.
Like, the goal is to maintain some affordable, like, apartments for people to live
mm-hmm.
in. That is the goal, right?
Yes.
So,
But you can't, I guess the point is, in the real world, if you say X and say, this is our goal in this community to do this, if you're going to buy here, you have to do this, how many people are going to be like, okay?
I just feel like maybe if those people are like, oh, I don't like the sound of that, then maybe there, I mean, very likely there are other people who would like the sound of that.
But that's just your impulse. So that's why economic analysis goes into this stuff, because you make a decision, and all of a sudden we enact a law, and then people don't buy in the community, and then you have a stress tax base, and you're back to where you were, like, 20, 25.
But then the real estate values just go down, and then people can afford apartments.
Or then the quality of life drops immensely, and the people are living in buildings who are... working poor start suffering like they did under Phil Geller type buildings. You get this circular problem. So we have to, it's a balance. So, you know, we have to, as much as we want to do the idealistic thing, we have to make sure we're doing the right thing. unfortunately, because it's still a market-based economy that we consider.
I know, but at a certain point, it just feels like those kind
of... Let us go back to reality.
Rats are just sort of like...
What's wrong about something? We're talking about something that is in here. As drafted, as conceived, this is new construction.
That's right.
But, you know, and I don't... And unless you want to clarify it,
well, what we were talking about is anything that triggered a...
Above the threshold.
Well, it's again, it's forget the unit threshold, but it does not really deal, it says all new residential developments.
What are you looking at right now?
The law that we brought.
The law that you started drafting.
Okay.
All new residential developments. We do not define, well, it says, residential, it says creation of one or more dwelling units for single two family or multifamily residences. Do we want that to include conversion of existing housing stock?
Right, so this was an early draft. It was meant to trigger the next draft.
Right, well, that's the question I'm asking about. What do you want to do?
That's a very...
That's a fundamental question.
And that's going to cause a lot of consternation.
Well, it's a big difference as to whether you're actually going to do anything or not, because if you're eliminating it to essentially the new construction or building a new building, you're not going to have maximum flexibility of laying it out. There's a lot of judgment calls on this. You have very few of those. John said most of the ones you're getting now anyway have an affordable component anyway.
Right.
So large density.
And it's a density and whatever, they're doing it. And so are you going to say not doing that, but you're going to do it any time you're creating a new unit in a building or something, or creating four new units, or reconfiguring, taking an older housing stock and gutting it internally, cutting up new apartments.
Right. And again, that's back to the point of when people come to buy a house that's been turned into a multifamily unit and they want to convert it back into a single family home. Suddenly this law will say, no, you can't.
No, it doesn't.
It could.
Well, it doesn't currently.
It does. It depends what you want.
But if you're going, like, if you want to make it about all construction, then that would be a point of conflict. And we have to.
No, I think what we were, I mean, if we were making it about all construction, it would be about, it would still apply just to the kind of building that we're talking about, which would be four units or more.
True.
So I don't see what the problem is there.
The question is, like, if you're going from the penalty for down, like, conversion that goes, that takes units off, or is that considered conversion, or is it no?
That's not part of what we've been discussing. Okay. I mean,
definitely
I'd be
not.
Curious to know if there are things like that in other places. Because
I sent examples a while ago.
You brought it up, and I didn't see the examples.
Sorry, I didn't call
them. Yeah, I saw
that. Find them. But I don't think that's part of, like...
Okay, I'm just sorry. Can you explain more what you were saying?
I was just saying, if someone takes a... Because there are homes here that are multi-unit apartments that were once single-family homes, so if someone decides to convert it, if it's under the threshold, they're allowed to do it. In our law, convert it back to single-family use, and you lose the apartment stock at that point. Then there's no penalty for that, but that's just how it happened. And in our draft that we gave Jeff, we had it as new construction and sort of avoided... The issue of conversion.
Well, but that wasn't a decision we made. It was simply the way that we did the draft.
The action as drafted right now is kind of vague. It's not necessarily
clear. It's not defined.
As well as it should be, as you want it. But it's a question of how do you want to do that. And where is it likely to come in? I mean, if you have...
It probably wouldn't come in.
We had some like... pocketbook factory, or you're taking a factory and you're converting it into apartments, you would cover it, you would want that covered. If you have a existing, let's say, two-family, and you're dividing it up into four units, if you could, is that covered?
I think it would be a good idea for it to be covered.
Why would you want to disincentivize them turning it into four units?
Well, is it a disincentivization, or maybe... or is it
much more expensive? Without the same return. You're making them...
Well, one of the things... Okay. Oh, I remember now what's going on. You were going to work on a tax abatement
didn't. No, that's not true. I did work on it. And the point is, like, we would have... Essentially, we'd have to borrow from another initial goal for all this was like, why can't a homeowner decide that they want to rent out part of their apartment, right? That if they have a unit, that they want to rent it to a lower, someone with a...
I thought we were pretty certain on that one. We needed legislation for that.
We would need legislation for that.
That was
basically the spur of this in the large review. Why can't homeowners get the same benefit that someone like Alan could get if they decide to have a workforce unit? Right. So, and you seem to suggest that we can't do it. New York does. New York City does it. Different places do it with different economic.
Well, they have legislation.
Right.
Can't the owner do it in terms of their taxes?
I don't know if you could get a tax.
Somebody who was a tax person mentioned that to me, and I'm not sure it's true or not.
From what I found,
I don't think we can be clear. It's essentially creating a new tax classification code under the real property tax law, and I don't believe that, you can just set that as state.
Again,
right, but I'm saying,
they set the class codes.
Again,
I'm not saying us do it. I'm saying the person who's filing their taxes, who owns this unit.
But that's the existing one that would make them eligible to use that for, and that goes to John.
Okay.
So it's going to only be available for larger development.
Right, and so if we were to do it on a smaller scale, again, how do you monitor it? How do you be self-monitoring it?
Well, wouldn't the treasurer's office be monitoring that?
I don't know, but I mean, it seemed like a very simple idea and a simple solution, and it turns out to be much harder to actually make that an effective self-reporting. You know, you don't have, who knows if people are actually going to be doing
anything about that in the state, in terms of there's special tax evasion programs.
And I remember I did look at this, and I couldn't find much on it.
Mm.
They were not really specific to like each municipality.
So I know programs, not what you're talking about in New York now. Like there are de-restricted programs, and the most effective when you get the school board on too.
Right.
And the county, and so I've seen this work on bigger scales. Like Ithaca has done this pretty successful, not in the way you're talking about, but de-restricted.
De-districted?
De-restricted.
Oh.
So you can't make a huge profit on selling your house. You can only make a limited amount to keep it affordable. I've seen a lot more accessory dwelling unit incentivization programs.
In New York City?
No.
Okay.
Not in New York. California.
Oregon.
That's the mother law apartments.
What you're saying you've never seen at that scale.
No, but I also haven't
looked.
I think
like
New Orleans, there's a lot of different exemptions for taxes, depending on if you can prove how long you live there and other things. So I've seen
tax
exemptions.
Right. And who's responsible for enforcing them, within the city structure?
In New Orleans, it was the assessor's office.
Mm-hmm.
And it was tied to. Also, there's a lot of houses that came through the urban renewal, redevelopment programs in FEMA already had a lot of restrictions baked in there. So they're already being kind of monitored for things anyways.
Mm-hmm.
We are a small city, so it's we're not talking about monitoring 5 million.
Yeah.
I guess the question too is how much new development do you I still haven't gotten a sense of the quantity and the type of developments you're picturing. Because most cities too typically have different policies, whether it's a 3-point lockup versus a pocketbook factory. It's usually not one size fits all ordinance.
Right.
So I'm not sure what you all are picturing in terms of.
Well, we had made this just simple grid that showed if it's 5 units or more, it's this number mm-hmm. of affordability, and then it's up to. But there is a finite amount, I guess, of possible development on a large scale, and so. So what are you asking? You're saying how much action would this get
applied to? Yeah.
I guess it sounds kind of we're throwing stuff at the wall and see what sticks to create affordable housing, and. I know simplicity is really ideal, but also the more targeted we are, then we can also understand what are we actually trying to get with this particular program, and then that helps us understand how are we monitoring it, and are we just trying to get any affordable units, or are we trying to Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Kind of.
The more targeted.
I mean, like, so for example, you know, there was some talk about, and I don't know what's happening with it, the lower union, the old co-op building.
Yeah, that disappeared. I don't know what to do.
It disappeared.
I mean, the Galvin.
The Galvin-owned property that's on Warren Street between Front and First is... There was an introduction, an outside developer that maybe was like partnering with Galvin or something like that.
It wasn't clear. Galvin was probably going to do nothing except either sell it or take a land lease.
Yeah.
The way it was proposed.
Right. But it was being proposed as a market rate. And like.
And probably high end market
60
rate.
60 units, something like that. So those kinds of things are possible to happen. And I think that the idea is that there needs to be affordability baked in.
Okay, but then that 50-60 unit, like that feasibility, that bar between like market rate and what's feasible is much smaller than like a 40 unit.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because like those small rehab or like renovate, like you're talking about like something on Warren Street that someone's trying to make, that's pretty way more expensive than even making a 50 unit. And so like, the incentive structure changes just because the cost of that development is so different.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess the question is like, do you just want more affordable housing? Do you want more affordable housing like on Union and Warren?
Well, yeah, I mean, I actually do believe that, I think historically it's been really true. Well, like, okay, so as much as, I don't know, 6 years ago, there were still plenty of naturally occurring affordable housing all up and down Warren Street,
mm-hmm.
for example. A lot of the shops had apartments above them that were not expensive. And then Airbnb happened. A lot of those units were not on rentally available. And so, you know, it seems to me that like the scattered site thing is actually about trying to not end up with, really just completely luxury
apartment stock
in our entire city, except for where it's subsidized.
So I think
or undeveloped or unrenovated.
You have tools to create more like large scale affordable housing units to get them on the market, right?
Yeah.
This might not be that tool. This
no,
might
totally.
Be a tool that gets like more like 80 to 120%
yeah.
Right,
sure.
Absolutely.
Sure.
That's
okay.
What we're talking about.
And then I just like yeah.
So then we're talking about two different things though. I mean, can it be covered in the
I've been going on the impression from what we're talking about that this whole thing is just going to be workforce.
That's
yeah.
what, we're, that's what
yeah.
it is.
It's
I don't understand it.
It's either. Never to be more than that.
Okay.
It's not going to be lower.
Correct.
Never.
Yep. This is we called this the workforce housing program.
What I meant by two different things, two different scales of development, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
can one law apply to both?
Well, again, we created a little grid that talked about
so what do you mean in terms
size
of scale?
Units,
yeah.
Well, it's all
scale.
Workforce. There's nothing in here that limits, the scale. I mean, if there's a building big enough to do a 100 units, we're proposing. Well, we didn't
go up to 100
units.
Yeah.
It's all workforce.
Yeah.
It's all workforce.
Yeah, I get
yes.
that. I get that.
I
get that. Okay.
Which you don't need a table for, obviously. That was one of my notes on this actually.
Cool.
So, I mean, perhaps Michelle and Jeff could meet to construct this law and make it into something so that we can actually move forward with this.
And also, Michelle, what would be your, given best is the wrong word, what's your opinion on a fee, if there's a fee for someone to pay into in the law?
Yeah.
Right?
Because
if you make something too high, then that's the same thing as a taking, let's say, because it's something that's prohibited for a smaller developer, then what's the sweet spot for a fee? Your opinion should be high enough to help the trust fund.
Well, I think we just, I mean.
I was like,
well, I was asking Michelle a question, so.
Mm-hmm.
I think a high fee is like definitely in most cases I've read how you get more units constructed. and most cities like have learned the hard way that their fees are way too low.
So I think like,
well, I was thinking is what's the you. If the cost of construction is 300 a foot,
mm-hmm.
okay, and the average size of a unit, or a, you know, maybe you know, two bedroom unit, or how we do it is 900 square feet, 500 square feet, what's that?
I would have to like.
So to say, for a safe argument, 1,000 square feet per.
For mm-hmm. argument, for argument, 1,000 square feet. So 1,000 by 300 is.
3,000. Well, I guess that's my point. You make it then double, would you double that to make the incentive, or does that become a, you know, does that then fall beyond an incentive?
And I do. I think you sent around an article that contained like a lot of just sort of like lessons learned on its inclusionary.
We understand that there's a problem. Just asking directly to that point is that like taking a construction to get that $300,000, like Jeff just said, would that in your estimation be too low? Should we then say you would double that?
I think that's a pretty good number.
Well, now we're just picking one.
I think that was like if you're doubling that, I think that's pretty high. I think I would feel more comfortable if I could talk to you all about this after. I talked to
right.
the developer.
Good.
And I have another one talking to Mara that can give you some like concrete numbers.
Cool.
Yeah.
And then I think the other thing to think about too is I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
Yeah, how about I'll get back to you on another
yeah.
fee. Yeah. I'm not
so
sure. Okay. So somewhere north of that.
So if you could talk to Jeff and maybe help him
yeah.
get this moving.
When's the normal meeting?
The 17th.
The
17th. Well, the 9th is the informal.
No, this committee.
Oh.
I'm so
sorry. Oh,
yeah,
what's the today's the second Wednesday?
Second.
First. Who said that?
First Wednesday.
Oh, first Wednesday of month.
You know, but I propose that we meet again before a month from now because this is really, really.
But as granted, Jeff's process here, we're also discovering that there's quite a bit of.
Look, we've talked about all these things already. Like, I just have to say that we have touched on everything that we touched on today, we have touched on in the past.
Rebecca, there's nothing wrong with making sure now that we have a show working.
No, totally.
There's nothing wrong with taking enough time to make sure that you're doing it right rather than just.
Sure, but it's just like.
Assume we should move.
No, it's. However, there. I don't feel convinced that there's been anything really happening in the background on this.
Okay, well, we'll make sure it does.
Cool.
Is also August. You're looking for a special meeting? Is that what you're
thinking? I mean,
I'm on vacation from the 22nd.
Okay.
Cool.
The other thing too is that like we as a city don't, once we have the housing trust fund going, we'll be more active in like creating new units, and so fees will be more valuable to us.
Right.
Because then it's like, you think of like at scale, right? $200,000, you can't do much with it, but if you're already doing things, those fees can help us plug in. But like that's gonna be like 3 or 4 years from now. So right now the fees are less valuable because we're not constructing units.
Mm-hmm.
So like this will change with time as like this will change.
Cool.
And then also if we make a fee, we should also plug in like inflation calculator.
Mm-hmm. Which would be just set like a threshold set 2 or 3% whatever. Just roll
like,
the inflation.
Yeah, or like this.
Okay.
So that's good. I don't know if we'll be able to squeeze in something before then, but looks like we have a better plan.
Well, I feel like we've
set I'll get number one draft before I'm on vacation.
Okay. Cool.
Just to recap, we've basically zeroed in on a law that has a fee.
Yes.
Right?
Correct.
That's it.
So do you want to exclude an incentive bonus? Maybe we should look at what that looks like physically, right? Like, just picturing where this would happen. How many units? Like, is this sort of Like, I know we have on the books already, but like, if it would actually happen, you know,
right.
like, what does it actually look like?
Right,
mm-hmm.
right.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm inclined to have it because, you know, but also it has to synchronize with preservation concerns. So.
Just, I'm not saying have or don't. Say
right.
It.
And you get back?
Later.
Later, okay. Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
And so also.